It's Friday, June 24th. It's American as Apple Pie, or carrying your gun in public. We start here. The Supreme Court declares that Americans have a basic right to carry a handgun.
This is essentially a ruling that says there is a national right to carry.
This was a monumental decision. We'll walk you through the caveats. The Attorney General resigned over bogus claims of election fraud, but hundreds more almost followed him.
Your entire department of leadership will walk out within hours.
With a peaceful transition hanging in the balance, prosecutors describe what almost became a Sunday night massacre. And it's been a year since an apartment tower came crashing down in Florida.
And we still don't know what brought the Champlain Tower South down.
So why hasn't every other high-rise in town been inspected yet? From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. Today marks exactly 1 month since one of the deadliest school shootings in this country's history. And every day since then, American lawmakers and voters have been asking themselves serious questions about what weapons regular folks should have access to, what should be more tightly regulated.
It is common sense to require background checks for guns.
We have a duty to come together, get something done that will save lives.
Some states had already acted on that idea before this. In New York, for example, there is a law on the books saying if you want to carry a concealed handgun in public, you not only need a permit, you need a good reason to do it.
The Supreme Court of the United States of America has stripped away the state of New York's right and responsibility to protect its citizens.
Yesterday, in the most significant ruling on guns in a decade, the U.S. Supreme Court said that law is unconstitutional. We spent years asking whether conservative states would be forced to restrict gun rights. This ruling says even in states that want to restrict guns, they might not be allowed to.
Because now more than ever, especially in Joe Biden's America, every law-abiding citizen should have the God-given right to defend themselves and their loved ones, no matter where you live in this country.
Reverberations here around the country. So let's go straight to ABC's senior national correspondent, Terry Moran, who covers the Supreme Court. Terry, can you just walk me through this ruling?
Yeah, it is a big one. It is a sweeping ruling on gun rights in the United States, written by Justice Clarence Thomas for 6 conservative majority on that court, the 3 liberals in dissent. And what this says, Justice Thomas says that the right to carry a weapon on the streets of the United States presumptively belongs to every American. And that what New York State was doing, which was saying, well, if you want to carry a weapon in public, you need to demonstrate that you have a special need for it. You're in danger in a special way. Not just I live in a dangerous neighborhood, but you yourself personally are in danger. And Justice Thomas threw that out saying that, no, you have to look at it the other way. An American has a right to carry a weapon in public unless the government can show that there is reason to deny that right.
The Supreme Court decision was keeping me up at night. It's clearly reached the point where we won't have any sleep.
The mayor of New York, Eric Adams, a former police officer, said New York City will become more dangerous, that more people will die because of what the Supreme Court has said.
We cannot allow New York to become the wild, wild west. We will not allow our city to live in fear that everyone around us is armed and that any altercation could evolve into a shootout.
This is a ruling that says from now on, the Second Amendment must be interpreted according to its text. You have the right to keep and bear arms. And in light of the history, colonial through the 19th century, early 20th century, of gun regulation in America. In effect, it essentially empowers people around the country to stand up and say, I want to carry my weapon in public. And if I can get a permit to do so, a background check, whatever like that, then I will.
The biggest gun ruling previous to this was this idea that, you know, you couldn't tell people they can't even have a handgun in their home, that the idea to have a handgun, like you should be able to have one in your home, provided you do everything else right. This expands it to you can have a handgun in the street. Practically, does that mean that anywhere I am, somebody is allowed to have a gun under their jacket that I can't see?
No. The short answer is no. There are some caveats in this opinion. First, you know, if there are traditional good reasons for the government to deny you the right to carry a weapon, if you're a felon, if you have other issues in your background that disqualify you from carrying a weapon, That's one thing. And he also leaves the door open for what are called sensitive places. He mentions courthouses, naturally, but also other government buildings and voting places where, by tradition, once again grounded in the history tradition of the country, firearms were not allowed. The question is, does that include a place like a nightclub or a football stadium? Now, those are usually privately owned establishments, and so they aren't covered by this. But there are places where the state is running a park or something like that.
Like the New York City subway, right? Like, can someone have a gun across from me?
Exactly. The New York City subway. Can the state bar people from having weapons in that? That is to be determined.
This decision isn't just reckless, it's reprehensible. It's not what New Yorkers want. And we should have the right of determination of what we want to do in terms of our gun laws in our state.
Thoughts and prayers and calls for more gun control isn't enough. How about letting me defend myself from evil?
The problem is that states are differently situated when it comes to public safety. New York is very different than Wyoming. That's always been the case in this country, and we've always had a kind of checkerboard of gun safety laws around the country. That, under this ruling, is no more. This is essentially a ruling that says there is a national right to carry.
Right, and it's worth noting here that this is not a 50-50 issue in most of the country. There's been polling on whether Americans think somebody should be able to just have a handgun regardless of a permit, which would go further than this Supreme Court ruling, but you get the picture. And in some of these surveys, only like 1 out of 5 Americans think that handguns should be that available to the average person, that states should not be able to regulate things like that. And when you look at this ruling this week, when you look at the abortion ruling, which could come as soon as today, if not perhaps next week, both of these, you could see a very conservative court flying in the face of what a lot of Americans think. Terry Moran, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, President Trump threatened to fire him until all his colleagues threatened to quit. The high-stakes meeting that paved the way for January 6th after the break. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Have you ever wondered what you would do with an extra hour in your day? I think about this all the time. I'm like, I would be so productive. I'd exercise more, or I'd read a book, or I'd take a nap, like restore myself. We often find ourselves yearning for these extra hours, but the real question is, what would you do if you were making yourself a priority? Well, how about therapy? It can help you discover what's important so you can make the most of your time. If you've ever benefited from therapy, you know how transformative it can be. It's not just for those who have experienced major trauma. Therapy empowers you to learn positive coping skills, set boundaries, and become the best version of yourself. If you're considering starting therapy, you should give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and tailored to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire. You'll be matched with a licensed therapist. And here's the beauty of it. You can switch therapists if you're not finding the right fit. No additional charge. Take the first step. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/starthere today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/starthere. We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but when it comes to your health, there should be no compromise. Don't go back to that one doctor. You know the type, like I've had this person before, that doesn't actually listen to you or who seems just in a rush to end your appointment that you spent months making. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable, listen to you, and prioritize your health. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. You can search by location, availability, and insurance, so no compromises here, because with ZocDoc, you got more options than you know. We're talking about booking appointments with tens of thousands of top-rated, patient-reviewed, credible doctors and specialists. Go to ZocDoc.com/start here and download the ZocDoc app for free, then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc, ZocDoc.com/start here. ZocDoc.com/start here. It's always powerful to have big institutions on your side, because then you can say, this isn't just my opinion, this is what the experts, the institutions say. And that is crucial to understanding what was happening in the days after Election Day of 2020. The vote totals were in, they were counted, they were recounted. President Trump and his allies were telling everyone he had won, but state officials weren't buying it, namely because Trump had zero evidence to say that. So what better way to get people to take this claim seriously than to have it come directly from the top prosecutor? prosecutor in the land, the attorney general, head of the Justice Department.
Felt the responsible thing to do was to be in a position to have a view as to whether or not there was fraud. And frankly, I think the fact that I put myself in the position that I could say that we had looked at this and didn't think there was fraud was really important to moving things forward. And I sort of shudder to think what the situation would have been if the position of the department was, we're not even looking at this until after Biden's in office. I'm not sure we would have had a transition at all.
Yesterday, the House Select Committee heard more testimony on what it calls an attempted coup by Trump. And according to these lawmakers and their witnesses, Trump's team was pushing relentlessly to install new officials at the Justice Department. Didn't matter who they were, they allege, as long as they said the election was a sham. Let's go to the person who's been spending her days in that committee room. ABC's Catherine Falders is at the Capitol right now. Catherine, who was testifying yesterday, and why was this so significant?
So here's who you heard from. You heard from the man who was leading the Department of Justice in the final days of the Trump administration.
The president either called me or met with me virtually every day, with one or two exceptions like Christmas Day.
That was the acting attorney general, Jeffrey Rosen, his deputy as well, Richard Donahue. And then you also heard from Steve Engel.
When the president, my recollection is that when the president turned to me and said, Steve, you wouldn't leave, would you? I said, Mr. President, I've been with you through four attorneys general, including two actings attorney general, but I couldn't be part of this.
Who was one of the chief lawyers over at the Department of Justice. Look, this hearing overall was important because it showed what the committee says was Trump's pressure campaign on the Department of Justice.
Where is the DOJ and the FBI in all of this, Mr. President? You have laid out some serious charges here. Shouldn't this be something that the FBI is investigating? Are they?
Missing in action.
Is the DOJ investigating?
Missing in action. Can't tell you where they are.
You've heard all about these pressure campaigns throughout the committee hearings, whether it be on the former vice president, on the states. This was solely focused on the Department of Justice.
Okay, so take me back to, like, Election Day comes and goes. Trump's team is saying, this state was bad. This state was bad. And the current attorney general, Bill Barr, is saying, no, it wasn't. What happens from there?
So there was a flurry of activity going on at the time, Brad. As you know, we were reporting it out at the time, and you heard in the testimony that they had all of these meetings in December. Now, this was just days after Barr resigned.
I made it clear I did not agree with the idea of saying the election was stolen and putting out this stuff.
Bill Barr's last day was December 23rd. Right. There were these theories about seizing voting machines, appointing special counsels of outside Trump lawyers. So all of these theories are swirling while these justice officials, these former top level officials, were telling him in various meetings throughout December into the new year why these theories were illegal and why the department wouldn't get behind them.
You also noted that Mr. Rosen said to Mr. Trump, quote, DOJ can't and won't snap its fingers and change the outcome of the election. How did the president respond to that, sir?
He responded very quickly and said, essentially, that's not what I'm asking you to do. What I'm just asking you to do is just say it was corrupt and leave the rest to me and the Republican congressman.
So Bill Barr leaves the Department of Justice, and the immediate pick to take his place was his deputy at the time, which was Jeffrey Rosen. He becomes the acting attorney general of DOJ, and he wasn't willing to go along with this plan.
Well, and so because with the Justice Department, there's always been this thing where the attorney general has to be able to, like, push back on the president. The president wants you to investigate something. You think there's nothing there. You have to be able to tell him no. So in this scenario, this would be the end of the line. But it apparently wasn't the end of the line, right? Trump was allegedly saying, well, let's just hire a new attorney general to say what we want.
No. And look, in various meetings that were detailed during the testimony, Jeff Rosen described Trump saying, well, he was just going to get rid of them or fire them potentially if they didn't go along with this plan. But it wasn't the end of the line because, as we learned, Trump had his eye on this official at the Department of Justice who was an environmental lawyer. His name was Jeffrey Clark.
I made the point that Jeff Clark is not even competent to serve as the attorney general. He's never been a criminal attorney. He's never conducted a criminal investigation in his life. He's never been in front of a grand jury, much less a trial jury.
He was aligned closely with Trump's beliefs that he could overturn the election. So Trump was trying to do everything in his power to install Jeffrey Clark in the highest rank at the Department of Justice.
The president didn't care about actually investigating the facts. He just wanted the Department of Justice to put its stamp of approval on the lies. Who was going to help him? Well, Jeff Clark.
So that all sets up this dramatic showdown at the White House on January 3rd.
The conversation at this point was really about whether the president should remove Jeff Rosen and replace him with Jeff Clark.
This meeting in the Oval Office, it was contentious. It was with Department of Justice officials, former President Trump, and they were essentially saying, you can't do any of these things.
Early on, the president said, what do I have to lose? And it was actually a good opening because I said, Mr. President, you have a great deal to lose.
We won't do this. DOJ is not going to get on board with this.
He said, so suppose I do this. So suppose I replace him, Jeff Rosen, with him, Jeff Clark. What would you do? And I said, Mr. President, I would resign immediately. I'm not working one minute for this guy.
The White House counsel, the lawyers in the White House are agreeing with this. And he essentially, he being Trump, essentially threatens to fire them. And they talk about Jeffrey Clark coming in. And look, all of these officials said, okay, if you install this man, Jeffrey Clark, as AG.
I'm telling you what's going to happen. You're going to lose your entire department leadership.
Then your whole department will leave.
Every single AAG will walk out on you. Your entire department of leadership will walk out within hours.
This isn't just high levels of the Department of Justice. You'll have federal prosecutors across the country. They will resign en masse. Actually, it was described by someone as DOJ would just be a graveyard.
That comment clearly had an impact on the president.
Wow. So, okay, just to recap, President Trump is moments away. The letter is written, the title has been changed from installing a new attorney general that everyone else in the room is saying is vastly underqualified. His sole qualification, it would appear, is that he is okay using the pulpit of the DOJ to say all these election results should essentially be thrown out. And just at the very last minute on this fateful January 3rd meeting, do these lawyers, these Republican lawyers, stand up and say, we are all out of here, all of us, if you go through with this charade. And, like, there was even more to the hearing than that, right? Like, people started asking for pardons? What do we know about this?
Look, I think members of Congress were then realizing that they could have potentially participated in something that was illegal.
The only reason I know to ask for a pardon is because you think you've committed a crime.
They went to the White House. You saw an email the committee showed from Mo Brooks, a member of Congress, saying that all of the members of Congress and senators who I believe you wrote objected to or signed on to objections from the states of Arizona and Pennsylvania, all of them should just be pardoned. Wow. And look, I was talking to some sources about these pardons prior to the hearing, some sources with knowledge of the inner workings of the White House, the Trump White House at the time, who were just saying that they were getting phone calls about blanket pardons. Pardon me for anything I have done if it relates to January 6th and then anything I might do in the future, right? I should say that, and I'm looking at these have been coming in from yesterday, that in the immediate aftermath of the hearing, some of these members of Congress have come out and denied that this is true.
Yeah, vociferous denials from some of these members of Congress. In the meantime, I thought it was interesting the way Chair Benny Thompson closed this out, saying this shows you January 6th was not just about a violent attack. This was a political coup that was underway that would have succeeded, save for a few people. The violence only came after that attempted coup failed. Catherine Falders in the Capitol. Thank you.
Thanks, Brad.
So we talked yesterday about the earthquake in Afghanistan, and it seemed like the sad inevitability, right? In a country with poor infrastructure and more informal housing, buildings are going to collapse more easily. And yet here in the United States of America, it has been exactly 1 year since a high-rise apartment in Florida just collapsed.
Hey, the Champlain Towers, the building, it collapsed.
A bunch of us are in the garage, but we cannot get out. So we're going back up the stairwell. The garage is inundated with water.
The Champlain Tower South was a 12-story condominium complex built on the sunny shores of Surfside, Florida. It was one of many large buildings near that beach, but this was the only one that suddenly fell down, killing many of those inside.
98 victims have now been identified,
including 97 victims who were recovered from the collapse and one person who passed away in the hospital.
And so here we are 1 year later. You'd think that by now we would have a very clear idea of what happened. If you don't know, you'd have to assume it would happen anywhere. And yet that is exactly the situation some of these other buildings find themselves in, still digging for answers.
Were the buildings themselves given resources that they needed to make sure that their infrastructure was secure?
Okay. Can we do it better? Can the processes be done? Absolutely.
And officials in the area are still wondering why more of these buildings haven't even been inspected since. ABC's Victor Oquendo is based in Florida. He's been working with our investigative team to get some answers. Victor, I thought I was going to start this with you by having you remind us what caused the collapse, until your team pointed out to me we still don't know what caused the collapse. Is that right?
1 year later, Brad, and we still don't know what brought the Champlain Tower South down. It has been an excruciating year for the families, those who survived, and those who lost loved ones there.
I just kept looking and looking. I'm like, where's the building?
So far, no definitive cause just yet. It was just this month federal investigators provided an update, and they can't pinpoint anything just yet, and also say we're about a year or two away from a final report. I should mention, our team also spoke with the investigator hired by the town of Surfside.
I think we'll be able to eliminate a number of causes.
And this guy's got tons of experience. He was on the ground after 9/11. He thinks we might be able to narrow it down to maybe three causes, something like that. But he doesn't ever think we'll get to one final answer.
The spray that come from the coast, the rising sea level, the saltwater intrusion, all of that needs to be taken into account when designing buildings. Beachfront.
A lot of the theories out there, maybe shoddy materials to begin with, poor upkeep and maintenance. Maybe there was erosion just because where it was located on the beach, you got all those storms, wind, rain, or there could have been construction from the building next door. There's a lot of theories here, Brad. No final answer yet.
Clearly, a lot of what I would call stop signs were run through. And, when you compile this many mistakes on top of one another, that's how tragedies occur.
Now, at this point, investigators are going through all that rubble. You know, this building came down. It's called a pancake. You know, all these floors just stacked up on top of each other.
There was no voids. I mean, it was unprecedented in regards to the lack of void for survivability.
They're still going through all of it. 13 floors all coming down right on top of each other. And they're still finding, which is incredibly gruesome and rough, but they're still finding human remains in that rubble 1 year later.
Wow. Yeah, I was wondering, what has it been like for families of the victims and for these unlikely survivors? What has this last year been like?
Well, the families still want answers.
I remember hearing, people crying for help, and that's still, that bothers me still to today. I felt like I left him behind, but I had Esther in my shoulder, and I figured I had my family, and I said, I'm going to go get help.
Now, recently, there have been a few settlements, big numbers too. For those who lost someone in the collapse, that settlement totals to over $1 billion. And for those who survived but lost their property, that settlement right around $100 million, Brad.
We pushed them and begged them to keep searching.
We spoke with Martin Langesfeld. He lost his sister the night of the collapse. This is the kind of family that held out hope all along throughout the search and rescue mission that they would find her sister alive. Ultimately, she passed away.
They found human remains in a pile that I had to do a press conference for, pushing them and begging them not to throw away. Because a few months back, they said there was nothing of value in this pile.
Just an incredibly painful phone call to get for this family that's already been through so much.
Well, and that makes me wonder, Victor, obviously officials said nearby older buildings should be examined to make sure the same thing can't happen again. So how many of those buildings have been inspected by the town at this point?
So what we've learned, Brad, is that this is much easier said than done. After that mandate went out that all buildings should be inspected, we found out that 30 of them are in Surfside, and credit to our ABC News investigative team, we found that only 10 of them were inspected by the town.
Wait, 30 buildings, 10 have agreed to these initial inspections? How does that happen? What about the others?
Yeah, here's the thing. The town really has no authority to require this. Now, we did find that some are in the process of doing this or that they're on a waiting list for inspectors.
Building departments don't have the manpower, staff, or the money to check a whole design. They rely on a registered engineer or architect or whatever to do that.
Not enough oversight. And there are other issues, like not enough structural engineers to go around or, Brad, the money to pay for it.
As a town, we've tried to, you know, evolve and make things go faster. So digitizing the process, the inspection where they could submit it, be reviewed, bringing more people in-house to review these plans, the permitting process, we're all trying to speed that up to help with that safety.
It's a time-consuming process. And Brad, I should mention that recently Florida Governor Ron DeSantis did sign some condo safety reforms into law. These would require statewide recertification of condominiums over three stories tall. And that recertification will be required after 30 years or 25 years if the building is within 3 miles of the coast, and then every 10 years after that.
You only have a limited number of structural engineers that are being pulled in every direction, and boards are contacting engineers constantly saying, please check my building.
So the Champlain Towers South, that was 40 years old, and they were going through their 40-year recertification process that was required by Miami-Dade County when it collapsed last June. But here's the thing, there is so much more to do, and quite frankly, not enough structural engineers to handle the workload.
Yeah, this 40-year recertification process, then as they're completing that, one of these towers goes down, which is why so many people are saying that should happen more often, more quickly. Victor Oquendo there in Florida, thanks so much.
You got it, Brad.
All right, we're going to take one more quick break. When we come back, a slice of American history that's been missing for 100-some-odd years has just been found. One last thing is next.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
And one last thing. When you think of America's grandest traditions, it's tough to picture what they would have looked like a century ago, like Mardi Gras. Could there have even been a time when it wasn't all about whatever this is?
Barb, what did you get this beat? Well, I had to show you something.
Well, recently, a researcher found what appear to be the very first moving images ever recorded of Mardi Gras, the most significant historical find in the history of the holiday.
Where are you right now? Like, I can hear birds chirping above you.
Oh, I'm in the French Quarter.
That is Louisiana native Mackenzie Roberts Beasley on a much quieter day than Mardi Gras. She's a film archivist by trade. Well, recently, a colleague told her what he had just learned, that somewhere out there was a film of Mardi Gras from 1898.
And he called me and said, hey, I really need your help. Can you do anything? And he sent me the title of a film. It was Mardi Gras Carnival. And it was in 1898.
So she did what she does. She got to work and discovered that these old reels were sitting in a film library in Amsterdam.
They look about the same size as the 35 millimeters, similar to what we have now. Sprocket holes are definitely different.
And when you put them through a projector, you see something extraordinary.
It's very, very crowded, but the interesting part is there are no barricades, as you would see today, and no one is throwing any beads.
The hats were different, but the throngs of people were the same. The architecture hasn't changed much from what you think of as the French Quarter. This was Mardi Gras in its original form. Nowadays, there's a pretend bull that's paraded through the city. Well, back then, they used a real one. Float designers say they have never seen so much detail as what is on display in these images.
So this is the oldest footage of New Orleans ever, and it is the crew of Rex.
The king of Mardi Gras is called the Rex. Well, here was a Rex whose own descendants had never seen him like this. Here he is, this moving, living person.
It's a true time capsule of an era because it doesn't look like anything that we do now when it comes to the style, but the floats are very similar.
The film is less than 2 minutes long. It's silent. But in a world where history can fade so quickly, it's never too late to see the world through someone else's eyes. Start Here is produced by Kelly Therese, Jen Newman, Brenda Salinas Baker, Lewis Millman, Madeline Wood, Vika Aronson, Iru Ekpenobi, and Tara Gimbel. Ariel Chester is our social media producer. Josh Cohan is our podcast manager. I'm our managing editor. Liz Alessi is the head of ABC Audio. Thanks to Lakia Brown, John Newman, and our intern, Nania McLean. Special thanks this week to Josh Margolin, Cindy Galley, Ben Siegel, and Ben Gittleson. I'm Brad Milkey. See you next week.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table.
What is happening here?
It's just beautiful chaos.
Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view.
To be honest, I was thinking about asking him for a foot massage, and then I just froze.
This is the best gig on TV.
And you know, anything can happen.
That is what we do here.
I'm not going to lie, the chair's a little small for my behind.
The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.